This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Gerald Walker, is the author of a new collection of personal essays called How to Make a Slave and Other Essays. The title comes from Frederick Douglass's famous line, "You have seen how a man was made a slave. You shall see how a slave was made a man." The book includes essays about growing up on Chicago's South Side, learning how to prevent his personal essays from turning into cliches about ghetto life, raising his two sons in a predominantly white suburb a block away from the college where he and his wife were teaching, and wondering what impact that would have on their lives. He's the author of two previous books, Street Shadows, a memoir of race, rebellion, and redemption, and The World in Flames, a black boyhood in a white supremacist doomsday cult. That book is about growing up in a family that belonged to the worldwide Church of God that preached the races should be segregated and the apocalypse was imminent. Walker is a professor of creative writing at Emerson College. We recorded our interview Thursday, October 29th, before the election. Gerald Walker, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks for having me, Terry.
Let's start with a turning point in your life. You were in the Iowa Writers' Workshop and submitted a story that you thought was quite good. It was about growing up on Chicago's South Side. Describe the story or personal essay that you had turned in.
Pretty much everything I wrote back then was about how white society had pretty much ruined the lives of black people, and we were miserable, angry, bitter, and poised for absolute failure as a result. That was pretty much my theme at the time, and I submitted it to workshop, quite proud of myself for really capturing what it meant to be a black person in America. And my professor, James Allen McPherson, had a different view. And he, when he began to critique the piece, he prefaced it by talking about how black gangster rappers often use similar themes and tropes in their lyrics, but often these rappers don't live those lifestyles and in fact are quite successful and wealthy. And then McPherson, to my absolute horror, accused me of doing the exact same thing.
And you were really angry, and you confronted him about it. What did he tell you about staying away from cliches about being black in America and about growing up in the ghetto? Because you had told him, like, everything I wrote in this is true. And, like, describe what you told him when you got really angry with him.
Well, I didn't sleep after workshop because I was so upset. And I called him the next morning and demanded a conference, and he agreed to meet with me. And when we met in his office, I went through the characters one by one, and I pointed out that they're real people. These are my siblings. These are my friends. We live in this community. I'm not making this stuff up. I'm not simply using these tropes for the enjoyment of a white audience, which is what he accused me of. And I demanded that he apologize. And he was so stunned, I think, by my response that he stormed out of the room and he ran into the hallway, and then the director came chasing him in one direction and someone else chased him. And I sat there for maybe 5 minutes watching these people run back and forth, seeing my future career as a writer go right down the drain, because I was a huge, huge fan of McPherson. And I felt that he had somehow misread me, misread my story. And if this man, this black man who I so admired, saw no value in my stories, then I felt that there was no hope for me.
I'll interject here that he was the first African-American writer to win a Pulitzer Prize for writing. So, I mean, you not only admired him, he had real stature in the world of writers. But you thought about it and then talked to him again, and he gave you some advice, which is very interesting advice, and I'd like you to describe what he told you.
Well, I think one of the things that caused us to sort of not see each other in the proper light is that what he thought that I was doing, which was trafficking in stereotypes, and I was, I don't deny that, but I was also a young writer, and I simply didn't have a handle on my material. But he said something to me that was so valuable that it did change the trajectory of my entire writing career. He told me that stereotypes are valuable, but only as a way to entice readers into the text, because what they are presented with at the beginning is familiar territory. But once they're in the text, he told me, you have to show them what's real. And I asked him, what's real? And he said, you. And I didn't know what he meant by that, but I reflected on it for about a year. And I went back and I asked him to do a directed study with me because I wanted to study myself to figure out what is real. And the thing that I came to realize after working with him for several years was that the philosophy that I had adopted, that Black people were primarily victims of white racism, was false by the very fact that I had overcome these obstacles to even be in the writer's workshop. And we're talking about a place with a 3% acceptance rate. And yet there I was standing there proclaiming that Blacks had no future in anything because we couldn't overcome our obstacles. And so he made me see that I was focusing too much on the obstacles in a Black person's life, too much on racism, too much on oppression, but not on the very qualities that made it possible for me to find myself standing before him.
So he wanted you to write about the strengths of Black people and the things they've overcome, even if they're not having a successful career as a writer or getting into the Iowa Writers' Workshop.
Exactly. It's not the victory. It's the fight. And I think that he made it clear to me that I was failing to talk about the fight. And he made the point that for people who could endure the brutalization of slavery and its aftermath, by necessity had to be more than the sum of that brutalization.
And just to be clear, he wasn't saying, you know, like Black people can just pull themselves up by their bootstraps and nothing else is standing in their way. You could achieve whatever you want to. He wasn't taking that approach.
Not absolutely not. What he was simply saying is that we don't come from a tradition of defeat. We come from a tradition of resistance and fight and struggle, and that these are the qualities that make it possible for people to have success. But there are also the qualities that simply make it possible for you to situate yourself in the whole span of humanity. That we are people, like all people, who do not simply identify themselves solely as victims of some oppression or some obstacle.
There's a story I'd like you to tell, and this is a really, you know, horrifying story. You were 21, it was 1985. You were on the way to buy coke from a friend who was a dealer when you were robbed at gunpoint. Describe what happened.
I dropped out of high school when I was 16 years old for a number of reasons, but one of the main reasons was that the high school I went to was so crime riddled, and just getting there and back was an ordeal. And so I got involved with drugs and alcohol, and by the time I was in my early 20s, I had a strong appetite for cocaine. And a friend of mine was a dealer. I didn't have any money, but he said he would give me some on credit if I simply went to pick it up. And so I went to his place of business, and I walked into the alley to go to his third floor apartment, and some guy came out of the shadows and put a gun to my head. And he asked for money, and I said, I don't have any money. I'm here to get drugs on credit. I'm broke. And he searched my pockets. He couldn't find anything. And he told me to go up the stairs and get my drugs. And so I did. I went upstairs. I saw my friend. I told him what happened. We both laughed about it because this sort of thing is pretty common. And I got the drugs and I left. And 30 minutes later, I received a phone call from my brother saying that my friend, the dope dealer, had been shot. He'd been murdered, shot 6 times at the very place where the man had put the gun to my head. And I have never stopped believing that one of those bullets was for me, that I was meant to die that night in the alley. And it motivated me. That very night was the last night that I ever used drugs. And I had to turn my life around because I had just been giving a preview of what was coming for me.
But it sounds like you had previous encounters that would have been kind of frightening. I mean, you had been robbed at gunpoint or knife point before. You had friends who were in jail, friends who were killed, family who had been in jail, family that was shot. So what was different about this episode?
I think the thing that made this one different was the feel of the barrel of the gun pressing against my temple. And there are close calls, but you can't get much closer than that. And I knew that it was simply a matter of chance that that man had not shot me. And the other instances, as with this one, when I got upstairs and saw my friend and we laughed about it, the close calls are kind of funny because there's a little bit of a distance to them. And you think, yeah, that happened. It's happened before. It'll happen again, but I'll be okay. But when you have the gun against your head, and when 30 minutes from that point, the friend you just saw is lying in a pool of blood where you stood, that makes something click that nothing else had the ability to make click.
Had you thought about the possibility that the guy who held the gun to your head would follow you up the stairs and try to get drugs that he could either use or sell?
I thought that there was a possibility he would be waiting for me when I came down. But I was prepared for it. I was simply going to give him the drugs and go about my way. But by that point in my life, having lived in that community and communities like it, you're so used to these encounters that they almost don't faze you. And you usually leave them with your life intact. It's just another event that happened. You tell your friends about it, you get high later, and you even laugh about it. But when it reaches an end like this one reached, it shifts your perspective on things. And I could have continued to lead that life as my brothers did in that community. But I just decided that I've got to see what else there is out there.
Both of your parents were blind. Were they both blind from birth?
No. My father lost his sight when he was 12 years old. He fell down a flight of stairs, hit the back of his head, and started having migraines. And then his vision started leaving slowly. But he was so afraid of what was happening that he didn't tell anyone. And finally, after I think about 2 months of his vision dimming, he was having breakfast one day with his grandmother, who was raising him at the time, and he knocked his fork accidentally off the table. And he turned to reach for it, and he froze. And his grandmother said, "Tommy, pick up your fork." And he said, "I can't." And she said, "Why not?" And he said, "Because I can't see it." And that's when his grandmother figured out that something was wrong with him, and so they rushed him to the hospital, and the doctors found that there was a clot on his brain that was affecting his vision. He was promised that surgery would solve the problem, and he had brain surgery, and the doctor made a mistake, we believe, because when my father woke, the small amount of light that he could see at that point was completely gone, and he was absolutely 100% blind from that point forward.
What about your mother? Was she born blind?
My mother was not born blind. She was born with what we believe to be glaucoma. But in rural Arkansas in 1936, there was no way of having it diagnosed because they didn't have access to medical care. And so one of her eyes was clouded with mucus. And so they did what you do in these communities. They tried home remedies, which included urine from a cow, cigarette ash, drops of gasoline, cigarette smoke, and an assortment of other things until one day the tide of mucus receded and basically left a small gray stone. So that was that for that eye. And then later when she was 9 years old, she wanted to go out to play one day and her mom said, "No, you have chores to do." And my mother did not want to do the chores. And so she ran outside and she turned back to see if her mother was chasing her and didn't see that in front of her, her brother was driving a wagon with a 2x4 in the back of it. And by the time my mother turned back around to see where she was going, her brother had stopped the wagon and the 2x4 was in the perfect position to come in contact with her good eye, which it did.
That sounds horrible. One of your earlier memoirs is titled "The World in Flames, A Black Boyhood and a White Supremacist Doomsday Cult." And you grew up in what you describe as a cult. It was the Worldwide Church of God. What did that church... Tell us a little bit about that church.
All right. I'll begin by saying it was awful. One of the things, well, this is the basic, the teachings of the church. They believe that in 1972, the world would come to an end of sorts, which is to say the heavens would open, demons would descend, there'd be earthquakes and fires and riots and looting, and everything would be pretty basically Armageddon. It would be terrible. But the people who were chosen, the chosen ones as we were known, would be taken away to a place of safety. And for 3 years, from 1972 until 1975, while this chaos and mayhem took place, we would be protected. And in 1975, by the end of this destruction, Jesus would return to earth and say, "You have seen what I can do. It's not good. Here is your chance to follow me." And everyone who decided to follow Christ at that time would be saved and have eternal life. Everyone else would burn in hell in the lake of fire. So for the people who agreed to follow Jesus, and why wouldn't you after all of this, the people who had been chosen would be his army. And we would be supervisors over this eternal life. And that seemed like a pretty good deal to my parents.
But it was also preaching segregation and justifying slavery. What language did they use to do that?
Oh, there's any number of verses from the Bible that you can use to justify segregation and slavery. And many of them can be found in Leviticus. I can't cite the chapter and verse now, but they're there because I heard them frequently. And we were told that the races were meant to be separated, that black people were the descendants of Ham. And we were cursed, and therefore we were supposed to be enslaved, that wouldn't be so much of a big deal in the afterlife, although we would still be segregated in the afterlife, but that was simply the way it was. And my parents accepted that, along with a lot of other black people, which still puzzles me to this day.
How seriously did you take this when you were growing up?
Oh, I bought into it 100%. I mean, when you're, you know, raised in a religion and this is what you're taught from birth, and I was, it all made sense to me. And it was a horrifying thing. And then we had a problem. 1972 arrived and the skies didn't open. 1975 arrived and Christ did not return. And then we started learning of scandals at the head of the church, that there was money being embezzled. There were a lot of sexual activity, there was child molestation, there was all of this stuff. And we slowly but surely realized that we had been victims of a massive, massive con. And so I discovered this when I was 14 years old, right when my neighborhood was going from being a middle-class neighborhood to being a slum. So having had all of my beliefs ripped from me, and then finding myself in this community where I had no idea how to think about myself and about the world and about life, I had to try to make myself into something new. And the thing that was presented to me, in large part by my brother, but by the community, was to be a young thug. That was what I had to replace the religion with.
In this time of growing awareness of the number of police shootings of black men and women and protests that have happened around the country, are you thinking back to your childhood, and did you have, or did your family and friends have encounters with the police that you're being reminded of?
Oh, sure. There was one incident in particular when a friend of mine, we were, I don't know what we were doing, something that caught the police attention. And they put us in the back of their squad car, and it's two white officers. And they were teasing us, and they were calling us names, and we were calling them names, and it kind of seemed to be kind of a funny thing. And they were taking us to prison. I don't forget what we were doing. Maybe just getting high. They caught us with weed or something. But they were taking us to prison. But something happened where these two officers had to go on a different call, and so a different squad car came to pick us up. And so my friend and I, we were probably 14, 15 years old. We got in the back of the new car, and I continued with the jokes. I thought, this is what we're going to do with the cops today. We're going to call them names. They're going to call us names. And so I started calling these two white officers names. And they weren't laughing. And they weren't in a joking mood. Until one officer, he pulled the car into an alley. And the second officer took my friend out of the car. And the first officer got in the back seat with me and put his gun in my ribs and said, I am going to kill you. And I think he might have done it if my friend had not started fighting with the officer that had him. He started screaming. He was banging his fist on the hood of a car, doing everything that he possibly could to get the attention of people, and people did come out to see what was going on. And my life was saved in that instant. But beyond that, we had regular encounters with the police where they would chase us, they would catch us, they would beat us. I don't know of anyone who was actually killed by the police, but there were many, many opportunities because we had some pretty intense encounters with the officers who patrolled our community.
Gerald Walker, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for the invitation. This was great. This was fun.
Gerald Walker's new collection of personal essays is called How to Make a Slave. Our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of a new album by cornet player Ron Miles that also features guitarist Bill Frisell and pianist Jason Moran. Kevin says Frisell and Moran apply the right finishing touches to Ron Miles' quintet music.
Ron Miles on cornet, shadowed by Bill Frisell on electric guitar. On Miles' album, Rainbow Sign, Frisell and pianist Jason Moran are around for more than name value. They help create the quintet's floating sense of time and add all manner of decorative details. Moran's lightly applied rock and roll piano triplets on Like Those Who Dream are like something heard in a dream. Ron Miles plays cornet, the trumpet's less flashy cousin, and he aims for a casual, offhand sound, as if it weren't nearly as hard to play as it is. He gravitates toward the horn's middle range and medium tempos. A conversational volume level gives his playing a confidential quality. He can ride a swing groove and show off his own slippery timing. The album Rainbow Sign is for the same quintet that recorded Ron Miles' more pensive I Am a Man in 2017. Thomas Morgan is on bass and Brian Blade on drums. This new music was inspired by a heavy subject. Miles wrote it while caring for his dying father, and his understated playing can be poignant. As a composer, Ron Miles has a pop musician's love of a good melodic hook. The Rumor could almost be a lost John Lennon ballad. Ron Miles has said he had a breakthrough when he embraced the influence of the pop music he'd heard growing up before he got into jazz. One tune's hook is worthy of Burt Bacharach, whose mellow brass interludes surely left a mark on Ron Miles' cornet sound. In fact, the first time he, Bill Frisell, and Brian Blade all recorded together was for a Frisell album of Bacharach and Elvis Costello songs. This is Ron Miles' A Kind Word. Much of the music on Rainbow Sign has a poppy accessibility, but it isn't quite easy listening. Ron Miles' frisky band stretches the material, lets things get a little warped. John Lennon and Burt Bacharach knew something about that, too. Pretty music that gets a little weird around the edges. That's a jazz and a pop tradition.
Kevin Whitehead is the author of the new book, Play the Way You Feel, The Essential Guide to Jazz Stories on Film. He reviewed the new album, Rainbow Sign, by Ron Miles. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Our next guest, Nicholas Christakis, says the virus that causes COVID-19 will circulate among us in some form forever. Christakis is both a medical doctor and a sociologist who's in a unique position to understand the science behind the coronavirus and place the current pandemic in the context of past attacks of deadly pathogens. Plagues, he writes, reshape our familiar social order, require us to disperse and live apart, wreck economies, embolden liars, and replace trust with fear and suspicion. He says they also elicit kindness, cooperation, sacrifice, and ingenuity. In his new book, Christakis surveys the course of COVID-19, chronicles some tragic mistakes made by our political leaders, assesses how the pandemic may end, and considers its long-term impact. Among his observations, if a vaccine arrives after two or three waves of the pandemic, it may be too late to make much of a difference. Nicholas Christakis directs the Human Nature Lab at Yale, where he's the Sterling Professor of Social and Natural Science. His latest book is called Apollo's Arrow, The Profound and Enduring Impact of Coronavirus on the Way We Live. He spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies.
Nicholas Christakis, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you so much for having me.
I was interested to read in your book that in other cases where we've developed vaccines for infectious diseases like tuberculosis and measles, and that often by the time the vaccine arrives, the infection rates have already naturally lowered dramatically. What does that tell us?
Well, that's a general principle in public health, which is sort of in the background of all of the conversation. That's called the McEwen hypothesis, which was a very powerful idea from about 50 or more years ago, where Thomas McEwen, the medical historian, observed that if you plotted on the x-axis time and on the y-axis the number of people dying from any given infectious disease, a tuberculosis or measles or diphtheria or whatever, and then you plotted the deaths, you have this sort of steep New England sled run of a graph, you know, where the mortality is high and then sort of drops precipitously. And then there's like a long straightaway, you know, when you get to the bottom of the hill and the sled is just sort of coasting along. And what he did is he generated these graphs for all these conditions. And then he put an arrow on the time point at which the specific treatment had been invented to treat that condition. So in the case of tuberculosis, it was isoniazid. In the case of diphtheria, it was antitoxin. In the case of measles, it was a vaccine, and so on. And what he found was that, ironically, that moment when the specific treatment was invented typically was on the flat straightaway of the sled run, long after mortality had disappeared or had declined substantially. And his correct argument was that really what causes the disappearance of infectious diseases is rising wealth and living standards and community and public health interventions. So the principle there is that what really matters in the control of infectious disease is not so much the pharmaceutical interventions, but the kind of way of living that we have. And that same principle in a smaller scale also applies with respect to the epidemic disease that we're currently facing.
Yeah, so let's play this out. You know, we're being told that a vaccine, you know, is being developed at warp speed, and maybe that comes in a month or maybe 6 months or maybe a year. Are you saying that it may not affect the infection rate that much?
No, I'm not saying that, because this is a bit of a different situation with an epidemic disease and the kind of acute, like, you know, novelty of the pathogen that's just striking us right now, and we're all vulnerable to it. I do think the vaccine is going to be very important. And if it arrives in time, I think it could play a role. Honestly, I'm a little pessimistic, however, that it will arrive in time to make a difference. You know, while we're trying to develop a vaccine, the virus is still spreading among us. Only about 10 or 11% of Americans are infected. Probably about 45 or 50% of Americans need to be infected before we reach herd immunity. And the virus is going to come back in waves over the next year or two. And more Americans are going to get infected. And eventually, we're going to reach that critical threshold probably sometime in 2022. So that's going to happen. You know, that is happening in the background, unless we went to be so extreme that everyone lived as a hermit. In other words, if we all just stopped interacting with anybody, we could stop the spread of the virus. But, you know, that's not going to happen either. So, or we could invent a vaccine, which I think we're likely to have a vaccine of unclear safety and efficacy, probably more than one vaccine, sometime in 2021. But you see, that's just the first step. Then we have to manufacture the vaccine in large numbers of doses, distribute it, which won't be easy. There's something known as the cold chain. Basically, the vaccine needs to be refrigerated from the time of manufacture to the time of injection, which is not easy. And most importantly, accepted. That is to say, most Americans have to be willing to take the vaccine. And that's going to take a year or something. So either way, we get to 2022, in my view. So my feeling is that, unfortunately, during what I consider to be the immediate impact period until 2022, we're going to be living in this changed world where we're wearing masks and and doing physical distancing, and you know, our economy is so adversely affected, unfortunately.
That's really a bummer to hear.
It is a bummer, but see, this is the thing. You know, plagues are also a time of grief. You know, that we're grieving not just the loss of people we know, you know, who died, or our health. We're grieving a loss of a way of life. We're grieving the fact that we can't have dinner parties with our friends. We can't go to movie theaters. I mean, this, just like we were earlier discussing how plagues are a time of lies, they're also a time of fear and they're a time of grief. And I think in some ways as a nation, we just need to, I won't say grow up, that sounds too flippant. I mean, we need to accept this unpleasant reality. And this is, again, where I think leadership is so important. I mean, one of the things that's crucial is public health messaging, credibility. You know, people who get up and tell it to us, even if it's uncertain, say, I'm not sure of exactly what's happening, but I think this is most likely, and here's the data, because we need to prepare the nation, in my view, for this reality. I mean, what makes us think that we're so different? You know, that we Americans in the 21st century in our wealthy country will be spared this fate. There's no reason we should be spared. And I think that preparing the nation to come to grips with this unfortunate reality is crucial. And, you know, we will see the other side of it. I mean, one of the things that's also important to recognize is that plagues do end. They have always ended. Even the bubonic plague ended. It's rare that they're so severe that the society is entirely annihilated, although that has happened too. But that's not the situation we're facing. So there is also grounds for optimism in ways we can talk about.
So at some point, you know, several years from now, what will our relationship be with this particular coronavirus? You say it will be among us forever.
Yes, I think a very likely outcome is that this virus will become like some of the other cold viruses, the other four variants of coronavirus that just caused the common cold. You know, I think over at least certainly over a century time interval, that's what's likely to happen. And what's likely to happen, I think, is that we will remember that in this particular virus, if you get it when you're young, it's relatively benign. And then I think you will have some kind of lifelong protection or long-term protection. It's unclear how substantial that protection will be. But what I think is likely to happen is that people will be exposed to this pathogen when they're young, will have a mild illness, they'll get some kind of protection. And then if they're re-exposed later on as adults, they'll get a mild illness again, as opposed to what's happening now when adults, all the adults on the planet have no immunity. And when they get it, you know, they're likely have a chance of dying. In a way, I think it'll be like chickenpox. You know, you get chickenpox as a kid, it's unpleasant, but you don't die from it. If you've never had chickenpox and you get it as an adult, you could die from it. So I think it's going to be sort of like that, is I think the ultimate outcome of this pathogen. But in the intermediate period, I think we're going to have to come to terms with it. I think it will settle down. I think we will reach, as I said, either herd immunity or from vaccination or more naturally. And, you know, it's going to become a fact of our lives, but we're not going to be living as we are now forever. I mean, I think what's going to happen is that the immediate pandemic period will last until 2022 approximately. And then we'll have recovered from the biological and epidemiological shock. But then if history is a guide, we'll have a couple of years of recovering from the psychological, social, and economic shock. And, you know, the economy is not going to bounce back immediately. People aren't suddenly going to go back to airports or restaurants. So I think we're going to have this sort of intermediate period of a couple of years till, let's say, 2024. And then beginning in 2024, I think we're going to have a kind of post-pandemic period.
If it's likely that we will be with this until 2022, when at some point we'll have a vaccine, but in the meantime, there will, you know, we'll more people will be infected, which will give us something closer to herd immunity. What about the argument that it would be smarter to simply embrace the virus, accept mass and quick infection, and get there sooner?
Well, let me explain why that's not a good idea in a very direct way. So if you had gotten this pathogen back in March, you would have had a higher chance of dying from it than if you get it today. Why is that? Well, because in the last 9 months, we've learned how to take care of you. And in fact, we have discovered that a drug called dexamethasone, which is a simple steroid, which incidentally the president also got, if given to you, if you're seriously ill, can reduce your risk of death by 20%. In other words, if you got seriously ill from coronavirus in March, you would have a certain chance of dying, let's say 25% chance of dying. But if you get it now, you might have, let's say, only a 20% chance of dying. That's a seriously ill, that is to say, now you would only have a 20% chance of dying. That is a big difference. And that's why we flatten the curve. So that's why not to go for the rapid herd immunity strategy right now. That's one illustration of the reason, is that by postponing the illnesses until a later point in time, we allow our scientists and our healthcare system to function better. If you get sick from this condition, like that's happening now, for example, in Utah and in Idaho and in parts of Texas and in Oklahoma, that are where there many of their hospitals in many cities are being overrun, when would you rather go to a hospital? When it's packed to the gills and the doctors are exhausted and the nurses are sick from the condition? Or would you rather go when the hospitals are operating normally? Obviously the latter. So this is why not to let the virus just run loose in our society.
What will be some of the lasting emotional impacts of the virus and the social isolation we've endured?
I think, first of all, in the long term, you know, in 5 or 10 years, I think society will have returned largely to normal, although there will be some enduring impacts, which in a variety of fronts, including things like working from home or certain economic impacts. On the more shorter term, sort of emotional things that you're alluding to, one of the things that's very typical, and we're seeing evidence for that in the United States, is during a time of a serious epidemic, religiosity rises. People become more religious. And that actually generally is reversed when the epidemic goes away. You know, saying there are no atheists in foxholes. Well, we're under a barrage right now, so, you know, people get religious. But then afterwards, the religiosity sort of returns to baseline. I think there's other habits that are happening right now that a little unclear how long they will last. But I think there's a lot more independence that's being cultivated. I mean, there's more home cooking and home plumbing repairs and home medical care. And, you know, people are expected to be more independent when, you know, social interactions are reduced and the economy slows down. I think there is, however, a lot of potential harm that's happening to our children from the school closures, from the fear of what's happening, from the job losses that, you know, let's not forget, tens of millions of Americans have lost their jobs. From this, I think we're going to have a serious recession that lasts for quite some time as a result. And I think young and other vulnerable members of our society will be preferentially affected. And many young people will carry these marks for a very long time. So there are a host of different kinds of impacts, social, psychological, economic, clinical, on different people, young, old, middle-aged, of different backgrounds, black, white, different races, different levels of wealth. It is a serious thing that's happening to us, and it is going to have multiple impacts.
You know, you've written that at times of plagues, people look for scapegoats. They sometimes turn on one another. On the other hand, it's a time when people need to come together to battle what's going on. What are you seeing here? Are we becoming more charitable, more empathetic, or the opposite?
I think both of those are true. I think there is, on the one hand, when there's a serious threat afoot, you can have a kind of temptation to have sort of every man for himself. But it's also in the nature of contagious diseases that we're sharing a common enemy. So the impetus to band together to confront the common enemy is heightened. And it's in the nature of this enemy that collaborative work is necessary. You need coordination, you need leadership, you need a way of working together to repel the invader. And that's the kind of an invader that we have. That's the kind of adversary we have in this virus. We must, and we are, slowly, but, you know, working together to confront the virus. And this working together includes things like collectively implementing the non-pharmaceutical interventions. It's almost an oxymoron. You know, we have to work together to live apart. But it also includes, you know, all the scientific and medical and other advances and public health advances that we're making. You know, we are working together as a species to develop knowledge that we can then use to fight the virus. You know, I'm optimistic in this regard. Like I said, you know, we're going to see the other side of this. I think Americans are going to see that that collaborative effort is required. I think as deaths mount in the coming winter, I think the motivation to do this will rise. And, you know, I have hope and expectation that we will do a better job than we have in fighting the virus.
What are some of the most informative insights that we have from the 1918 influenza pandemic, the so-called Spanish flu, you know, both in terms of science and social behavior?
Well, it is the last major respiratory pandemic that we've had in the last 100 years or so that was, you know, this severe. I think the 2019 coronavirus epidemic is probably going to be the second worst respiratory pandemic we've had. So almost as bad as 1918, but not as bad. And so it is important to look back and see what happened to the people then and how did they respond. But at the same time, to recognize that was a different era. That was before antibiotics. It was before modern telecommunications. The economy was much more rural. People lived already in a more spread out way. There was less urbanization. So many things were different. But there are other things we can learn that are actually quite informative. We can see the time period that it took for people to bounce back between the 1918 pandemic, let's say, and the roaring 20s. Or we can look at the impact of school closures. And a very nice study was done looking at and showing that the sooner that a city closed its schools, the lower the impact of the pandemic in that city. Masking is another thing. Ironically, there were the same fights about masking, if you can believe it, 100 years ago. In some ways, that's really depressing to me, that how little we've progressed as a nation, that we're still having these arguments. You know, masking is clearly helpful. There were anti-masking leagues, you know, in 100 years ago, people protesting the same thing, using almost the same arguments. But there were studies, scientists published studies showing that wearing masks reduces droplets. You know, 100 years ago, we had this work done.
Well, Nicholas Christakis, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Dave.
Nicholas Christakis is a medical doctor and a sociologist at Yale University. His new book is called Apollo's Arrow, The Profound and Enduring Impact of Coronavirus on the Way We Live. He spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies.